The next case is 00-1139, Akron Bar Association versus Michael Rich. Mr. Gray.
May it please the court, I'm Michael Gray, I represent respondent Michael Rich in this case. And at this time, I'd like to request a reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. And by way of a preliminary statement, and again, Mr. Rich, we respectfully request that publication of this opinion, if possible, not contain the name of his present employer. The court's report recommendation did contain the name of the employer. Mr. Rich requests that that be deleted or not.
We'll note your request.
I would direct the court's attention to the publication or the synopsis, the case summary published by the court's communications office on this case. And I would emphasize that Mr. Rich did turn himself into the Akron Bar Association in October 1998. And at that time, he had realized that his life had fallen apart and he had nothing going for him. He had no place to turn himself in to his local bar association. His sobriety date, as the report notes, is December 4, 1998. And since that time, he has undertaken a drug treatment program, has joined the Ohio Lawyers Assistance Program, regularly attends Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and lives a far different life than that exhibited prior to December 4, 1998. So, Mr. Rich's life took a sharp turn for the better after December 4, 1998, and since then he has tried to rehabilitate himself with the aid and assistance of Ohio Lawyers Assistance Program and the 12-step recovery program and other people who are like-minded. Prior to that, of course, he exhibited behavior that was outside the norm. It was dishonest and was the basis for the underlying disciplinary charges. Now, the board's report is curious, again, as your communications office has noted, because it ties its recommendation to Mr. Rich's sobriety date of December 4, 1998. And then in the next paragraph, your office notes that if the court were to adopt the board's recommendation today, Rich could apply for reinstatement in less than 2 months. But he had to take questions on that point, but our argument is that sanction, if any, should not be an indefinite suspension. It should be a definite suspension, recognizing, among other things, the mitigation factors involved, but also recognizing the underlying operative facts.
So even if credit for time served, in effect, is granted, you don't want a review of him before he comes back?
I'm not sure I understand the justice.
Well, that's the difference between the definite suspension and the indefinite suspension.
Yes, correct. We don't want to review. We don't have to participate in another hearing process. We have to go before another panel and explain why we should be reinstated. We believe that a sanction that expires with a mere lapse of time is more appropriate here, whether the sanction runs prospectively from today or some other period. But we believe that a definite suspension is warranted by the facts as opposed to an indefinite suspension. And yes, we would not want to have to go through a review process again. Yes, sir.
I know that there's that procedure of applying and the time it takes and all of that to get approved and the application fee and all is somewhat burdensome. But I get a little concerned that, is there some reason you think he might not pass the review?
No, that's not my concern. The fee, the money, the time, the energy involved, those are not concerns in the review process.
Well, then what's the problem? If we gave what has been recommended here, credit from December 1998, you know what the definite time is when the 2 years are up. You file your application for readmission, and if he is a person competent to be admitted to the practice of law, he's approved. What's the problem with that?
Your Honor, is that never before have I seen a report recommendation like this that ties a sanction to one's sobriety date. And so while I'm comfortable in this case that it could work for Mr. Rich, I don't know what this court is likely to do with that recommendation. And if you could tell me that, all right, we'll tie it to the sobriety date of December 4, 98, and he can reapply in December 4, 2000, that's fine.
Well, I'm not telling you that, but that's what they've recommended. And if we adopt that and issue an opinion that way, what's the problem in the reapplication?
Well, there wouldn't be no problem. As I say, I think the report is curious, that recommendation is curious, and it's unique in the annals of disciplinary cases, so I want to be able to rely on the precedents that this court has handed down, and I don't know that their recommendation is going to hold up for it.
What's unique with it? In the past, we have suspended indefinitely with credit for time served.
Well, you never tied the sanction window to one sobriety date that I'm aware of.
Well, forgetting the sobriety date then, if you don't want the sobriety date, we start the indefinite suspension at the time the opinion is drafted? You don't want that.
No, sir.
With no credit?
No, I'm looking for, ultimately what I'm looking for is indefinite suspension, for example, for 2 years or 1 year stay.
I know what you're looking for, and I guess I got to know why.
All right, the why goes to the underlying facts, sir, and that has to do with, if I can focus on the ABA standards for imposing lawyer sanctions, I believe that this is an addition case, it's not a conversion case. And turning to those standards, namely standard 4.112, which distinguishes between offenses that violate the attorney-client relationship. And the ABA standards talk about suspension generally being appropriate when a lawyer knows or should have known that he is dealing improperly with client property and causes injury or potential injury to a client. Now, that I suggest is one body of cases where an attorney steals money from a client. And those actions are appropriate under that ABA standard that I just read, and others under that section. However, it's our argument that this is not a conversion case, it's not a theft case, this is a case under another ABA standard, namely 5.12, that talks about violation of duties owed to the public. And there, the standards discuss lawyers who generally will engage in criminal conduct other than that described above, should be suspended in cases where their conduct adversely reflects on their fitness and practice. I submit that the facts in this case reflect on this person's ability to practice law and his fitness to practice law during the operative period. It's simply not credible to accept the complaining witness's testimony and for the panel or the board or this court to believe that this so-called victim lost anything, especially money, in using and participating in drug activity. I submit that instead of focusing on the case as a conversion case, the case is more properly framed as an addiction case where Mr. Rich, an attorney licensed to practice law, and his co-participant used crack cocaine. That's admitted, it's true. He bounced checks, he did a lot of crazy things. His life was in chaos, his life was unmanageable. But those things reflected on his fitness to practice law and his reputation in the community. I don't believe a sanction should be based on a crack cocaine user's conflicting testimony about his having lost money. This so-called victim never availed himself of the civil or criminal justice system to try to get a remedy. Instead, for whatever reason, he went right after the lawyer's ticket to practice, tried to grab him by the throat, probably to get the lawyer to give back or give him some money, by way of pressure. He never got a judgment. He never prosecuted Mr. Rich for so-called conversion or theft. Instead, he went right to the Bar Association and filed a grievance. That caught Rich up in the grievance process, and here we are today asking whether there should be an indefinite suspension as the board has recommended, or a definite suspension as we are arguing. So I think that in summary, Mr. Rich's behavior and conduct reflected adversely on his ability to practice law. I don't believe that the story that the drug dealer and crack cocaine addict should serve as a foundation for a sanction. And yes, I do want to, I do ask for a definite suspension, 2 years and 1 year stay, however the court wants to frame that. Again, I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Drain. Mr. Robinson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Michael Robinson. I'm here representing the Akron Bar Association this morning. I have also represented the Akron Bar Association at the hearing before the panel that was held on November 22, 1999. The first thing that I would like to point out to the Court is in your files there may be a copy of the transcript of that hearing. On page 3, there's a list of exhibits that were offered by both of the parties. There's an error in the transcript in that exhibits 1 through 11 are indicated as respondents' exhibits. Those, in fact, were exhibits offered by the Akron Bar Association and are relators' exhibits, and the one exhibit was offered by the respondent. I think that's important because one of the things I want to talk to you about this morning is the respective burdens of the parties and the efforts that were made to meet those burdens. I have a number of remarks I prepared. I'm going to forego those for a minute and try and respond to Mr. Drain's comments. I disagree that this is a case involving violation of a duty to a client in the big picture. We are here because of our perception of violation of disciplinary rules involving duties to the public. That's more important to the Akron Bar Association. The witness that testified, Mr. McIvory, is certainly someone whose credibility can be challenged, although he did come and make himself available to the panel, and the panel gave his testimony credibility and found that, in fact, he was entitled to funds that had been misappropriated by Mr. Rich. But aside from that, Mr. Drain spoke about the precedent of this case, and that is a very important issue in this matter to me. And that is because, as far as the respective burdens of the parties, the Akron Bar had the duty to go forward and prove violations of disciplinary rules. We listed a number of them. The panel, after our hearing, because we did not receive stipulations, found that we met our burden and proved violation of every single disciplinary rule that we raised. The respondent raised the issue of mitigating circumstances. The burden then shifts to the respondent to prove the existence of mitigating circumstances to reduce the sanction. That's what I think is the important issue here as far as the precedent goes. If the court reviews the records in this matter, the court will see that the only evidence presented of mitigating circumstances was the testimony of the respondent. I'm not familiar with cases in which the respondent merely appears before the panel and testifies as to all of the various factors involved in establishing mitigating circumstances. I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned because Mr. Drain refers to the ADA guidelines on imposing sanctions, and if the court reviews those and goes through the sections involving dependency on drugs or alcohol, the guidelines are clear as to what needs to be presented. It requires medical testimony. It requires proof of participation in a recovery program. It requires diagnosis of the respondent. It requires a finding by a qualified medical person or drug counselor that the respondent's conduct was the direct result of a dependency. In this case, if this court finds mitigating circumstances existed, this court is saying to the lawyers of this state that your burden is merely to show up and to say, I was diagnosed, I was found a dependent, I went to a recovery program, I'm recovered, and now I'm fit to practice law. We're here because we agree with the panel that there should be a reapplication process where this attorney needs to come forward and explain those circumstances upon requesting reinstatement. Frankly, the hearing that was held in November, in my opinion, should have been the most important hearing in Mr. Rich's life. And with the assistance of counsel, I didn't see the proper preparation and the proper evidence presented at that hearing. And I think someone in this state needs to determine whether we can entrust Mr. Rich with the authority to represent clients in important hearings, because I feel that he did not meet his burden in his own personal matter. And if he fails to do that, I think we need a review of his qualifications.
I know from your brief that you don't object to the credit for time served.
I don't, Your Honor. I'm the first one to say that I understand that alcohol and drug dependency can be debilitating. If Mr. Rich was in fact an addict, and I would refer the court to the transcript where even in his own testimony, which was always offered, where he said he was assessed, when asked what was the result of the assessment, the statement was that I was a potential cocaine addict and was at risk for alcohol dependency. But in any event, I don't object, because if in fact there was a substance abuse problem, and if Mr. Rich has conquered that, I commend him for that.
So you're satisfied with the board's recommendation?
I'm satisfied with the board's recommendation. I think that this court has clearly stated that in issues involving misappropriation of client funds, that disbarment is the appropriate sanction. I think that the respondent should be grateful with the panel's recommendation. We did not ask for anything more serious than indefinite suspension, but I think it's certainly appropriate that he appear and have, in essence, one more chance to adequately prepare his case and argue it and ask that he be reinstated. We certainly have no grudge to bear against Mr. Rich, but I am concerned about a precedent that says mitigating circumstances can be found based solely on the testimony of the attorney subject of the disciplinary matter. There was one witness, and that was a loan officer who was a fellow AA member, who said he thinks Mr. Rich is a likable fellow and was his sponsor and saw him at certain meetings. But as far as the testimony that he participated in Ohio Legal Assistance or Lawyers Assistance Program, we received no contract for that. We had not, I mean, if you look at the record, I did not object to all of the hearsay testimony of the respondent. I wanted the panel to hear it. If he was forthright, whatever he had to say, the panel could take it for what it was worth. Had there been letters, written analyses from medical experts or anything that might not have met the evidentiary thresholds, I think we would have had no objection to that, but there was nothing.
Counsel, you talked about the
variety
of what evidence did you have
to back? Well, that's another issue in our lack of documentation. There was a statement by Mr. Rich that he became inactive on a certain date. That's all we were presented with.
Do you have any evidence of what he did with his clients, or what he did with his secretary, or what he did with
his partner? His client files, Your Honor, were retrieved by the Active Bar Association. We received a call from his landlord indicating that the landlord had received calls from Mr. Rich's clients. Mr. Rich had not been in the office, and the landlord sought our assistance, and we did retrieve all of his files and attempt to deal with his client matters. The files were eventually, after they were reviewed and the pending matters were dealt with, the files and all the documents were returned to Mr. Rich, and he now has received those by receipt that is in evidence in the file.
We use it in credit suspensions when we got the suspension. We said we have an interim suspension for felony or something else. For somebody who's simply on their own taking stuff out,
well, I don't know what the respondent means by the statement, I went inactive. He apparently was not practicing. He testified that he thought he may have handled a few matters in that time period. I can't respond to what the respondent meant by that statement. The only thing I can say is that we are not seeking any additional time. Our main concern is with the integrity of the bar and the perception of the public and the maintenance of lawyers who owe a duty to the general public, not just this one client. I mean, this case was done because of NSF IOPA checks written on a closed account, commingling of funds that the respondent testified he never had any other account other than his IOPA account. And part of my response filed with this court is that there must have been some lucid moments that the respondent experienced. He had practiced for 10 years, he worked for a large firm in Cleveland, he worked for other firms. Certainly, at some point, he must have understood the duty to segregate funds, the duty to have a general account and an IOPA account. And if at no time he ever realized that, we need to be assured that someone will be making a determination as to his qualifications to continue to practice. And I think that the respondent asking for a fixed term suspension is attempting to avoid that determination, and we object to that.
Do me a favor.
The only other, I think I'll skip everything else ahead here, only to point out to the court that with the transcript of the November 22nd hearing, if this court reviews every word on every page, you will not hear the defendant, the respondent, say, I'm sorry, I had a sobriety date of September 4th, 1998. Since then, I have reflected on my actions prior to that date. I see that I have violated disciplinary rules. I see that I should have had an IOPA account, segregated funds. I will mend my ways and I will be better. Had we heard testimony such as that, perhaps we would have a different position today. I asked the respondent in that hearing, I think it's on page 31, about some IOPA checks for personal expenses, car repairs, karate lessons, student loans, and his response at that time, almost 2 years after his claimed sobriety date, was, well, we can argue about the auto expenses. Those were probably legitimate business expenses. To me, there was still, on that date, a failure to grasp what we should be doing as lawyers in segregating our funds from our client funds. And that, along with a number of other items, concerns me and the act bar, and that's why we're here today. So I would ask this court to please overrule the respondent's objections. Please uphold the finding of the board that the respondent be indefinitely suspended and that he should be required to go through the reapplication process and that he be given one more opportunity to appear and plead his case in a proper and appropriate manner. And I will leave it to the discretion of whoever hears that reapplication proceeding to decide whether or not he's fit to practice law. Thank you. I believe, Your Honor, he's working for an employment service called, it has something to do with legal employment. In other words, if a law firm needs a lawyer, they contact this company, and the name escapes me, but he then contacts other lawyers and seeks proper applicants.
He's really just a wonderful person.
He claims he is not dressed in his room.
Thank you, Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Drain, you can save 2 minutes of your time.
Usual person. But it was good. He's lucky he got this guy. That's up yet.
Just briefly, Governors, and Counsel's correct in that Mr. Rich does work for a lawyer recruiting firm is not practicing law. Now, by way of clarification as to going in after problems, phrase used by counsel for later, I believe the records of this court will show that Mr. Rich did apply in August of 1999 to go in after on the rolls, registration rolls of this court. But the chronology was that on August 1, 1998, his landlord locked his office door. So there was a big bat bill in activity on that date. He was unable to practice on after that date. In October of 1998, he turned himself in to the Akron Bar Association. On December 4, 1998, he had his first day of sobriety. Now, the panel hearing was conducted in November of 99. A month or two later, this court issued a Brown decision that said if someone is going to rely on chemical dependency for mitigation, he or she should have a diagnosis. And we recognize that that was one of the holdings of the Brown case. And then in June of this year, this court adopted amendments to the rules for the governing bar having to do with mitigation, and there it was codified that this diagnosis should be present. So in November of 99, when we had the panel hearing, the Brown decision had not yet been issued, the rules had not yet been amended, and to supplement the record, and I believe I served counsel with a copy of this, I filed a motion to supplement the record just to conform to the Brown decision to show that indeed Mr. Rich did have a diagnosis, and he had been assessed, and he was chemically. So we believe that we have satisfied those aspects of the mitigation rules, even as amended by this court. And I would trust that that does set forth the chronology of what happened. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Drain. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal is adjourned.